Oh, hello there, wherever you're listening, however you're listening, 88.1 FM or streaming us live from anywhere in the world on the WYPR app or at WYPR.org. This is Midday. I'm Gabe Ortiz, filling in for the immortal Tom Hall today. Monday is Gothic horror writer and Baltimore icon Edgar Allan Poe's birthday. We'll have Dr. Amy Branham Armiento, who is a board member for Poe Baltimore, to talk about how the city will be celebrating Poe's legacy. In about 20 minutes, we'll be joined by Michelle Eberly, the executive director of Maryland Health Benefit Exchange, to discuss the state of health insurance in Maryland as the new year brought little relief for Americans struggling with insurance costs. Right now, though, Scott Massioni, WIPR's health reporter, joins us to discuss the multitude of stories they've been covering lately in Baltimore. He joins me on Zoom. Welcome back to the show, Scott. How are we doing today?
Great to be here. Thanks, Gabe.
Always love having you on the show. You can join us, too, if you're listening along. Have you had to change your budget because of higher health care insurance costs, or has your loved one had the flu this season? Give us a call at 410-662-8780, or you can email us at midday@wypr.org. So, Scott, you, per usual, have been a machine when it comes to getting out stories here in Maryland and Baltimore for WYPR. And I want to start with one that I think has been affecting a whole lot of people, not just here in Baltimore and Maryland, but across the country, and that's the flu. We're deep into flu season right now, and this season seems to be particularly harsh, both in terms of how many people are getting sick and how sick they are getting. So let's start with the first part of that. How many people are getting sick right now throughout Baltimore and Maryland when it comes to the flu?
Yeah, you're exactly right. This season is extremely harsh. And obviously, we don't have numbers for everyone because they're not self-reporting every time they have the flu, but we do have the hospitalization numbers. And at this point, there have been 3,176 people who have been hospitalized due to the flu, and 9 people, unfortunately, have died from the flu this year. That's quite high, and the state itself considers the respiratory illness activity as of January 3rd as very high in their kind of deep red code. So things are rough out there. It's really important to wash your hands and stay safe.
And we've been hearing a lot that there are new strains of the flu out there. Is that a big part of what's driving this uptick that we're seeing in flu cases throughout Maryland? Or is this just the cycle every year that we see in flu season?
That is exactly what is pushing this right now. And I talked to someone named Andy Pacaz, who's the researcher at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He says that right now it's the H3N2 subclade variant of the flu that's really hitting people. And the issue with that is that the flu vaccine this year was not recommended before this came out. So it was recommended before this variant came out, which is causing a lot of people to get sick and really making the safety net a little different this year, and the calculus a little different this year than we're used to.
And just to piggyback off of that point, we have had a lot of discussion on the national stage about vaccine recommendations, and we're now getting into the part of the year where whether or not you get those vaccines could be the difference in whether or not you get sick or not, or how sick you get. And we're seeing these new strains of flu really hit people in a harsh way. Is the flu vaccine that people are getting this year, or at least this time of year, effective against these new strains? Or are we seeing this strain of flu battle back against the vaccine in ways that we haven't before?
It's a little complicated. It's still important to get your vaccine, and it's always important to get your vaccine. There's different variants of this flu that go around. There's the classic H1N1. There's other variants of this that the flu vaccine will protect you against. Now, this vaccine this year, as I was saying, the CDC recommended it before this subclade K came out. Now, the vaccine, if you were to get it, your body will still have antibodies that are used to seeing something that is similar to a flu and fight back. However, it's not going to be as effective as if the CDC had found the subclade K and said, hey, we're going to tailor this vaccine especially toward this disease. So unfortunately, it's not perfect. It's not the perfect fit, but the vaccine will always help you. and ensure that your body is building antibodies against something that is flu or flu-like. So, unfortunately, not going to help you as much as possible, but or as much as you're used to, but it will still help for sure.
My name's Gabe Ortiz, filling in for Tom Hall today on Midday, speaking with WIPR health reporter Scott Massioni. The General Assembly is back in session as of this week, and if you're following along, you can listen to WIPR's coverage with new State House reporter Sarah Petrowich, who is doing great work on our website. She'll also be joining Midday with some regular updates, so be sure to check the Midday schedule to know when she's going to be on. One thing lawmakers are going to be considering is legislation proposed by Governor Westmore to allow the state's health secretary to make vaccine recommendations. Scott, I'm curious what Governor Westmore is saying about this bill, because we have seen the federal recommendations coming from the Trump administration and his cabinet have a different perspective on vaccine recommendations and who should be getting vaccines and when they should be getting these vaccines. And a lot of states are taking matters into their own hands when it comes to their residents and how they're advising them to handle vaccinations. So what is Governor Westmore saying about the state of Maryland's vaccines, and particularly this bill that will allow the state's health secretary to make their own recommendations?
A little bit of background on this is that the HHS Secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., had really fired everyone that was on these vaccine recommendation boards and then rehired his own kind of people within these boards that made these changes. Now, for children, their new recommendations have gone from 17 vaccines down to 11. And that includes getting the recommendations, not getting the flu shot for children. So the states like Maryland, like Massachusetts, many Democratic-run states are taking, as you said, matters into their own hands and starting these public collaboratives, public health collaboratives. These collaboratives will allow them to exchange information, to talk about data that they have in terms of diseases, to continue building this coalition in terms of emergency preparedness. So what Westmore is asking to do is create something called the Vax Act. With this legislation, the health secretary would take into account these recommendations that we were just talking about, including ones from top medical organizations, and then make suggestions for which vaccines Marylanders should get, much like the HHS secretary already does. What's really important about this is the bill would guarantee that insurance coverage and pharmacists insurances would cover this vaccine, and pharmacists can administer it, in your regular CVS or wherever else. So really, it's going to be helping Marylanders have access to these vaccines that maybe the federal government won't be recommending as they had in the past.
410-662-8780 is the number to call if you want to join the conversation here on Midday. If you've gotten the flu this year, call in and let us know. Did it hit you harder than years in the past? If you got the flu vaccine, did you feel that it helped you in combating this season's really harsh strain of flu that's been making its way through the state and really all throughout the country? So sticking with Governor Westmore here, and, you mentioned that there is a collaborative happening that Maryland is a part of. I believe it's eight other states, so nine, including Maryland, in this public health coalition to issue their own vaccine recommendations and coordinate their efforts to get this information out to people. How unprecedented would you say this is, that we have states taking medical advice into their own hands, when I feel like in years and even decades past, there has been a pretty central messaging coming from the federal government, coming from the CDC about how to handle this? How unprecedented is this for states to come together and say, we're going to do our own thing this year?
This is absolutely unprecedented. I think it's only really been in the past 100 years, or not even that, probably back to the 60s, that the federal government has had such a hands-on approach to public health. So within that time, really with these vaccines, this is the first time we're seeing states sort of take things into their own hands, as you said. Usually we would have just focused on the federal government and what they would have recommended. So this is clearly a rift between Democratic states and the Trump administration. It's a way that the Democratic states and other states are trying to take matters into their own hands and say, look, we have a different idea on this, and we want to ensure that people are able to get these vaccines and have them paid for, which is really the biggest part, I think. And insurers will pay for them instead of, you know, people having to come out of their pocket to do it, or you know, have higher barriers to entry to get these vaccines.
I want to transition here just a bit. I want to stick with lawmakers, but move away from the flu. We'll be returning to that conversation later in the show. Lawmakers will again be considering decriminalizing drug paraphernalia, things like needles, syringes, and pipes. This is a story that you've been reporting on for WIPR, Scott. Can you talk a little bit about this bill? And currently, possession of drug paraphernalia, it carries a maximum penalty of 2 years in jail and up to $2,000 in fines. How would this bill change that?
Yeah, this is a move that Maryland has been working for, and especially Baltimore has been working on for quite some time, which is to move toward more harm reduction rather than punishment when it comes to crime. So as you said, if you are, you know, carrying something like a pipe or something like that, you wouldn't have these penalties. And instead, this allows people to, you know, not go to jail and have to go through more penalties for being, you know, just someone who's having a rough time, and instead, you know, maybe talk to someone who can help and, you know, help you not do drugs or to get off of these drugs. And you know, this is something that I think we've seen through data and also through studies that punishment is not a way that's helping people get off drugs, but rather keeping them in a cycle of poverty and, you know, drug use. So this is a different way to look at things. And it's something that the state had tried to pass in 2001. Governor Larry Hogan vetoed that bill. So it does have a pretty high likelihood of actually passing this year.
And I feel that in this conversation of substance abuse treatment, we often see this power struggle of something that you talked about, which is treatment versus punishment, right? And we often see these nonviolent drug users end up in the prison system, end up with a record, and end up drowning in fines and jail penalties for things like paraphernalia or for drug possession or drug use. We have seen the beginning of that turning around, I believe, with having people get their records expunged for marijuana possession, since we've seen cannabis get legalized all over the country, especially here in Maryland. Do you see this as a continuation of that trend?
It's definitely a continuation in how we're looking at drugs. And, you know, the Nixon administration started the quote unquote war on drugs, and we have continued that up until now, really. And it continues to go on. But places like Maryland, places in other states in the United States are trying to think differently about how this is working, because obviously over the 50 years since the, or more than that, almost more than 50 years since the Nixon administration, you know, the drug use is still here. It's still rampant. So the war on drugs clearly didn't work. One thing that I would point out that's really interesting about this bill is that the Maryland Department of Health's rapid analysis of drugs currently can only test drugs through needle exchange programs. So to find out what kind of drugs are in certain neighborhoods, if there are new drugs developing, ones that might be particularly dangerous. The nice thing about this bill is that it protects people who are testing these drugs, and anyone who brings in a certain syringe and says, hey, can you test this for me? Now they can test anything except for, and not just ones that are in these needle exchange programs. So it allows the state to have more data and to tell people, hey, there may be a new strain of drug that's in your neighborhood that may be dangerous. You might want to think about ways to protect yourself.
Another story that you've been working on here at WIPR, Scott, is a damning report on conditions at the state's juvenile detention centers. The report comes from the Maryland Office of the Correctional Ombudsman. Can you tell us what this report found? Because some of the things in it were quite disturbing.
Yeah, this is an, as you said, extremely disturbing story. There were issues. These are children in correctional facilities around the state. They were seeing things like rat infestations, inconsistent health care. There were some kids. There's one kid who is a paraplegic who was sitting in his own filth, basically, and was not being taken care of. HVAC systems that were not working, children in facilities that were 55 degrees or colder at night, wearing improper shoes, just stuff that's really subhuman to have to live through. And this was not only in one particular correctional facility, but all of them around Maryland. The ombudsman as you said, put out an extremely pointed report saying that these issues need to be fixed because these kids are living in conditions that are dangerous to them and also dangerous to the staff in terms of the staff was overworked, working mandatory overtime, and unable to properly take care of these children.
And the Department of Juvenile Services responded this week saying they do intend to address the issues outlined in the report, which I think most people would hope the response to something like this would be. But did they offer any timeline or any vision or plan on how this would be addressed and how quickly these problems would be solved?
Yeah, unfortunately, this response was woefully I would say under-explained and under-described. Yes, they said that they're going to fix these problems and said that they hired, pesticide and insecticide sort of services and that they're going to get maintenance to come in. But there was no timeline. There was no budget to it. We don't know what the Moore administration at this point is going to invest in terms of how to help this. But only in this response to the report got paragraphs saying that, no single report or quarter can fully capture the complexity of the work and that they remain focused on steady progress. So we don't know, if it's going to be next week or 2 years down the line when these things are actually going to be fixed. They said that they recognize that they need meaningful reform and that it requires sustained effort and transparency. But at this point, we're going to have to see if they're actually going to show up with that.
Yeah, again, a really disturbing story coming out of the Department of Juvenile Services. And I hope more information comes out because a lot of these things seem to be very basic procedural things, being able to keep the facility clean, being able to keep temperatures livable within the facility, and being able to have the staff to be able to deal, particularly with the juveniles in the system who need special services and special attention. And this report seemed like it was basically devoid of all of that, which I think anybody living in the state of Maryland would agree is unacceptable. I want to make one last transition here before we take a break. The Affordable Care Act expired at the end of 2025, sending premiums soaring for Americans this month. I mean, it's something that, again, is rather unprecedented, at least within the past decade or so. And if folks will remember, this was after the longest government shutdown in United States history. So as we are currently moving through this story, living through these soaring premiums right now all throughout the country, what else do you think folks need to understand about what's happening right now with the state of health insurance in the United States?
I think the unfortunate thing right now is that prices are likely to continue going up. We're going to see more and more people without insurance as these policies change. So the tax premiums that you were talking about that the government shutdown was all about, those have not, there's no road to getting them back. And so there's likely to be more and more people that will either drop out of their healthcare as they see bills increasing or not sign up for healthcare as they enter that market. And then in 2027, we're going to see Medicaid become a big issue as the Trump administration's new restrictions on Medicaid go into effect. In total, we may see millions or possibly tens of millions, up to 12 million people over the next 10 years or so, not signing on to healthcare. That means that the pool of people that the insurers rely on to pay into this system is going to shrink, meaning more people need to pay higher prices and higher premiums to ensure that they get the same care that they used to get. So quite a concerning story for people, and we're going to see how it plays out.
I'll tell you what, Scott, I'd love for you to stick around with us through the next segment. We're going to be speaking with Michelle Eberle, the executive director of the Maryland Health Benefit Exchange. And we're going to get more into this conversation around health insurance and how federal subsidies, which, again, are helping people pay for health care under the Affordable Care Act, has officially expired coming at the end of 2025. So if you're available, I'd love for you to stick around and join this conversation with Michelle.
Absolutely. Love to be here.
Excellent. My name is Gabe Ortiz, filling in with Tom Hall here on Midday, speaking with health reporter for WIPR, Scott Massioni. And again, on the other side, we're going to have the executive director of the Maryland Health Benefit Exchange to continue this conversation around soaring health insurance for folks all across the country. And we're going to be able to focus in on how it's affecting our fellow Marylanders. All that and more coming up on the other side. You're tuned in to Midday on 88.1 WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
This is 88.1 WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
Welcome back into Midday. My name's Gabe Ortiz. Just wrapped up a great conversation with WIPR health reporter Scott Massioni about all the different stories they're working on here at WIPR, which there is quite a lot. There is few better in this industry and in this city than Scott. So happy to have him on our team here at WIPR. If you missed that conversation, you can go back and listen later today on the WIPR app or at WIPR.org. Scott's going to stick around with us through this next segment as we are joined by the executive director of the Maryland Health Benefit Exchange, Michelle Eberle. Michelle, we got you on the line?
You do have me on the line. Thank you very much for having me here.
And thank
today.
You so much for making some time for us today. Now, this is a story that I was very excited to have you on for because it's one of those stories that is affecting everybody, right? We are seeing health insurance premiums go through the roof after the federal subsidies for the ACA expired at the end of 2025. So before we kind of get into the nitty-gritty here, can you just explain to folks who may not be familiar, what is the Maryland Health Benefit Exchange and what role does it play in Maryland's healthcare system?
I'd be happy to. We were created out of the Affordable Care Act, which that law passed in 2010, and states had the option to either create their own state-based marketplaces or join on the federally facilitated marketplace. Maryland, we've always, you know, wanted to do things our own way and have been very progressive and forward thinking on healthcare. And we said, hands down, we're doing our own. So that was the creation of Maryland Health Benefit Exchange to be the state designated marketplace for purchasing health insurance. If you are an individual and you pay for it on your own, you don't have it through your employer. We also run Medicaid, MAGI Medicaid through our system as well. So about one in five Marylanders come through the portal, which we refer to, the marketplace name is Maryland Health Connection. That's a consumer-facing name. And we also have vision plans and dental plans and do a whole lot of wraparound services that we provide in addition to getting people health coverage.
And you mentioned there that one in five Marylanders come through this system. I mean, that's about 20% of the state's population. So can you speak a bit more to the importance that this has in the state?
Sure. I mean, it's critically important. It's part of our entire health ecosystem of how we are providing healthcare coverage in the state of Maryland. And the open enrollment period that we just had focuses specifically on consumers that are purchasing their own health coverage. So that's about 300,000 in the entire market, individual marketplace in Maryland. So that's a number when we start diving into some numbers that we'll be referencing.
And we had a report from the Baltimore Banner, one of the news outlets, one of our partners here at WIPR, reporting that the state of Maryland saw an increase in enrollment, roughly about 3%. What, in your opinion, is leading to people enrolling more into this system as opposed to years past?
So this year is going to be a really interesting year because, as you mentioned already on this show, that there, you know, the federal government did not come through and do what they were supposed to do, what we had hoped they would do, which was continue allowing working class families to use their tax credits to help them purchase health coverage. So we knew we were going to be in a bind. And fortunately, in Maryland, again, our progressive forward thinking Maryland, last January, we thought, all right, if that happens, we're going to have a significant loss. Because healthcare is expensive to begin with, and if it goes up, people have to make decisions on, do I, you know, pay my rent, do I buy food, etc. So, with that, we put in place a state premium assistance program that was contingent upon the federal government taking action. When we ran our renewals in September, the federal government had not run those or had not extended those tax credits yet. So we just moved forward as if they were not going to. And we said we can always roll it back. So when we look at the numbers this year, we have to dig a little deeper because the narrative is going to be, oh, you had a 3% increase. But below that narrative, we started, our renewals were 12% higher this year than last year
Wow.
because of the fact we had the public health emergency unwinding where we took people off of Medicaid and we moved a lot of people from Medicaid onto private health plans. So we already were at a higher mark than we were. The numbers to really look at are new enrollments. Who's coming in new that is enrolling? Our new enrollments this year are down 12%. But again, that's a little nuanced because last year our new enrollments were higher. So then we dig a little deeper and we look, all right, who's disenrolling this year? And our disenrollments are up 49%. So now
Wow.
we start to look at, okay, 20, almost 28,000 people came in and chose not to have coverage. So now we got to dig a little deeper and find out, well, why are they not getting that coverage? Those that usually, or that don't get any premium assistance anymore from the federal government, I shouldn't say premium assistance, the use of the tax credits, that increased 43%. So that expanded tax credit really has had effect. Now, by putting in the state premium assistance, we are able to help 70% of all the people that have enrolled in health coverage. We've been able to help them out. So digging a little deeper, the bigger story is, well, what's happening to these people? We have a group of people that are under 100% federal poverty level, which is $30,000 for an individual, that are over the age of 55 and 65. Typically, these are folks that did not work long enough to get Medicare, those over 65, so they haven't put in enough hours to be eligible for Medicare. So they could come through the exchange and they could purchase health insurance. Now that cost of their health insurance has tripled. And we're seeing a lot in that age group over the 55 that is just choosing not to get coverage, which is a serious issue for our whole health ecosystem when you look at, all right, where is it going to go? The biggest change we saw is people moving from gold plans down to bronze plans. So about 34% of the people that we had enrolled move down to a lower plan. What that means is that when they're in a gold plan, they have a $1,000 deductible and they have really robust coverage. Now, moving to a bronze plan, they have a $10,000 deductible and less robust coverage. So now you have, again, middle class families working really hard, trying to do the right thing. Their financial exposure has just increased tenfold. At the same time, they're actually paying more in taxes to the federal government because they could have used that tax credit to help them pay for their health insurance. And again, we're seeing that primarily on the over age 55. So it's a real conundrum that we're in. And how it affects the entire health ecosystem in Maryland is you have providers that aren't going to see their patients anymore, so they're losing money. Patients will get sicker. They'll go to the emergency department. They'll increase wait times. There will be more uncompensated care. There will be a sicker community, which impacts our economic status, people, not going to work, people closing down their businesses for a week because they just are too sick to work. So all of that ramification, which again ties into the bigger, broader spectrum in Maryland of our AHEAD model that we have coming down the pike, our uncompensated care, how our hospitals are funded, and big. I mean, it just is, we're a little speck of this, but it's very big.
And we're seeing this domino effect play out across the board, right? My name's Gabe Ortiz, speaking right now with the Executive Director of the Maryland Health Benefit Exchange, Michelle Eberle. We're also joined by health reporter here at WIPR, Scott Massioni. And I feel like when we have these conversations, whether it's on a local level, on a state level, or a national level, we usually speak about these affordability issues in silos, right? We talk about housing and the conversation ends with housing, or we talk about health insurance and the conversation ends with health insurance. And I don't feel like we ever really connect those issues together. And there was a study that was just done at Johns Hopkins, which Scott reported on. And I want to bring you in here, Scott, to talk about what we just heard Michelle say and also talk about this study from Johns Hopkins in regards to the fact that if you are struggling to pay your health insurance, it's also going to be more difficult for you to afford housing, or it's also going to be more difficult for you to afford groceries. And I think that there are a lot of people, far more people than the average folk thinks, that can't afford to pay for their groceries, or can't afford to pay their rent, or can't afford to pay their health insurance. And they really lean on the government, whether it's state or whether it's federal, to be able to help out with one or two of those things. And if I can get some assistance on my health insurance, then I can probably afford groceries or rent for the month. Or if I can get help with my groceries, then I can afford the other two. And all these things play into each other. Scott, you did a great report on this Johns Hopkins study. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's just as you said, that what they found is that people who have health medical debt are going to be 44% more likely to not be able to, or to have housing instability. That means not paying their rent or going into foreclosure. And, you know, along with that, Michelle, I wanted to ask you, actually, you know, as people are going to see their bills and they're, you know, most people, not health reporters, they're not looking at their insurance news every single day. As people are going to be seeing their health insurance going up, you know, are you expecting that people may drop off their plans or possibly change them later on after they sort of see these bills?
Exactly what's going to happen, because the other factor is, in Maryland, there's a 30-day grace period, but if you receive federal tax credits, there's a 90-day grace period, which means that the carriers can't terminate you during that time. So we won't know the full story, although we'll try and learn as quickly as we can, but of those people that were just auto-renewed, right? So just like your automobile or house insurance, you get auto-renewed, but if you don't pay your first bill, then you get canceled. So we won't know the full story until the end of March, early April, when we go back then and look at, all right, how many people just didn't pay their bill, or maybe they paid it for a month and then had to decide. And again, who knows, as the year goes on, what other financial struggles are going to come in the along the way, and then make the decision, I just can't afford healthcare anymore.
Right. And along with that, you know, you saw 16% growth last year. This year, 3% growth. I mean, that is quite a difference. You know, you've really worked over these years since the ACA started and seen some extreme increases. And, you know, even though things are increasing, 3% is very different than 16% and what you've seen in the past. You know, what does that mean for Maryland? What does that mean in terms of what you're seeing as a chilling effect by these ACA premium tax credit cuts and possibly Medicaid cuts in the future?
Sorry. So it's notable. I mean, you think about if the disenrollments were up 49%, if those consumers could have afforded their coverage, think of the growth we would have had. You know, think of where our numbers would be today. So that's significant. And what we do know by the state premium assistance program, because that was up to $60,000 for an individual and up to $128,000 for a family of four, which isn't a lot of money for a family of four in Maryland. But we know that when you provide funding, people want health insurance, or you even know that by everyone moving from a gold to a bronze, not everyone, that group of people that move from a gold to a bronze, they're like, health insurance is so important to me, I don't want to lose it. And it's just the challenges, Maryland, we right now, today, we had only envisioned we would have that, the premium assistance program for 26, maybe for 27, because it was a chance for us to give Congress time to do what they needed to do. But it's so short-sighted that our Congress is not letting people use their taxes to help them buy health insurance. When people use taxes for many, many different things where there's tax credits.
You're tuned in to Midday with me, Gabe Ortiz, filling in for Tom Hall. We're joined by the Executive Director of Maryland Health Benefit Exchange, Michelle Eberly. We got just about a minute here, Michelle, and I want to ask you one more question before we let you go. Again, thank you so much for your time today. Maryland officials are reminding residents that they can check a box on their annual state income tax to find out how they can get free or discounted health insurance through the state. Can you give people some more insight on what that process looks like and what they will get from it?
You are one step ahead of me. I was going to close with that to say, even though that open enrollment ended last night, if you think you are you're able to get health insurance, just come on in and check out our website, apply, talk to one of our folks. We're always here to help you figure it out. We do have coming up, because we're entering tax season, if you're filing your taxes, we've made it easy. Check the box. Your information will come to us. We'll reach out to you and we'll help you get health insurance. Likewise, if you're like one of the many federal employees that found themselves without health insurance this year and you file for unemployment, there's also a check the box. So if again, many ways that you can, even if you're unsure, you can check a box, you can call us, you can come see us. We will help you figure out if you're able to get any special enrollment to get coverage.
Michelle Eberly, the Executive Director of the Maryland Health Benefit Exchange, thank you so much for your time. And also Scott Massioni, WIPR's health reporter, doing some great work out in the field. Be sure to check out WIPR.org or the WIPR app to stay up to date with all the great reporting that he is doing. Thank you both so much for your time. And hopefully we can revisit this conversation with some better news the next time we sit down and talk.
Thank you so much. I know.
All right, folks, I'll tell you what, we're going to step aside for a quick break here, but coming up next, we're going to be speaking with a member of the Poe Foundation, Dr. Amy Branham Armiento, also a professor of English at Frostburg State University, to talk about the upcoming, I don't know if I would call it a Baltimore holiday, but a big day here in Baltimore. We got an icon who has a birthday coming up. So we're going to talk about that, how we're going to be celebrating this icon's birthday. And of course, I'm talking about the one, the only, Edgar Allan Poe. More of that coming up on the other side. You're tuned in to Midday. My name's Gabe Ortiz.
You're listening to 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.